This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The theme of ethics reform continues to percolate through Springfield. For instance, should lawmaker emails be considered public?
You know, I haven't specifically thought about whether FOIA should apply to legislators. What I will say is that more transparency is better.
More on ethics from Governor J.B. Pritzker. Plus, the publisher and executive editor of Crane Chicago Business talks about the future of journalism. There's a talent pipeline from Decatur to Bloomington Normal. Find out why. And baseball has the hot stove league in the winter. Gardeners have seed and plant catalogs. It's WGLT's gardening podcast, Grow. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker took office a year ago. Since then, the state has raised its minimum wage, legalized marijuana, and passed several other pieces of legislation long sought by Democrats. Pritzker marked the occasion with a series of interviews, including with Brian Mackey. The conversation touched on ethics, the fate of clean energy legislation, and the value of red light cameras. Mackey began by asking Pritzker whether he had consumed marijuana since it became legal in this state.
No, I have not.
Have you ever consumed marijuana?
Oh, sure. When I was younger, I did, but it's been a long time.
Okay. We know the law limits marijuana to people age 21 and older, but this would not be the first such product that made its way to underage consumers. What do you tell your own children about using marijuana?
Well, I make it clear, number one, to all children, and my own certainly, that number one, it's illegal for them to consume cannabis in any fashion whatsoever. Number two, that there are real effects, negative effects, on young people if they do consume. There's interference with the growth of their brains, of their intellectual capability, et cetera. It's important for young people to know what the dangers are for them during those formative years. It's one of the reasons why it's important that we have a minimum age of 21 and older for people who are consuming cannabis.
Do you have concerns about the sort of normalization of marijuana use, even among adults?
Well, I think we all need to step back. You know, when we ask about the, you know, normalizing cannabis consumption, we have to step back and recognize people were already consuming it, masses of people. They were consuming something that was potentially unsafe, as we saw with the production, illegal production of THC vaping products. They were consuming something they didn't know where it was coming from. So it was completely unregulated. And the laws around it were being prosecuted in unfair ways, ways that the negative impact of which we're trying to reverse. So let's start with the fact that people were already consuming it. A second point I'd make is that, you know, when you're buying an illegal product from an illegal seller, that illegal seller is also selling other illegal drugs. And so I think we are making the availability of cannabis is making it safer for families, for people who are looking to consume, because they can go to a regulated dispensary and purchase a well-manufactured product that is safe.
I want to move to a topic that's been in the news this week, red light cameras. They've come up in multiple federal investigations. The controller said she would stop helping municipalities enforce collection of fines. Is there a safety benefit to those devices, to red light cameras, or are they just an ATM for local governments?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I understand from many law enforcement and public safety officials that they often believe that they are, in fact, public safety benefits to having a red light cameras. And certainly we want people to obey the law and know that there are consequences for not obeying the law. We have too many traffic accidents, and this is a way to help deter traffic accidents. So I think that's what I know from the professionals in the arena.
Is the idea that local governments, I mean, the controller herself said that it seems like there are a lot of abuses. These are targeting lower income people. Maybe not targeting is the right word, but lower income people are disproportionately affected by the collections her office was doing. Is that worrying to you?
It is. And in fact, you heard me say during my inaugural address during my victory speech, I guess, in November of 2018, that it's very important to me to alleviate the burdens on particularly low-income people of having their livelihood taken away by these kind of low-level fines that they're being held responsible for. I think I was referring in part then to parking tickets. But it certainly is appropriate to point to traffic tickets as another example of that. We don't want people to lose their livelihood. We do want them to follow the law and know that there are consequences to not following the law. But in the end, if you're low income and you can't afford to pay one of these tickets, we shouldn't take away your only way of actually getting any income to help pay it off. By virtue of taking away your license or restricting other activities that would ultimately allow you to keep your job, get a job, and so on.
I want to move to some legislative issues that I think could be topics of discussion as the General Assembly reconvenes later this month. Clean energy legislation has been tied to demands from the electric utility ComEd, parent company Exelon. Given the federal investigation, is that green energy initiative dead on account of that, or should it be handled separately?
Oh, it is. It is very much alive. Getting Illinois to comply, to move forward in its in our desire to bring more clean energy, to bring more renewable energy to our state. That's something that I believe very strongly in, and we're going to be working on during this spring session. We also have other major utilities that we need to consider. As you know, we produce a lot of nuclear power in the state. We produce a lot of other power, and all of that needs to be taken into consideration as we look to create a more environmentally friendly energy production and as we try to lower costs for people across the state and continue to be one of the most attractive states in terms of energy prices. So we have a lot of work to do, but the work is in. It's going to be in the spring session for sure. But that work is very much aimed toward us moving to complying with the Paris Climate Accords and the U.S. Climate Alliance, which I've committed our state to.
When you say nuclear energy, that means Exelon, and that means the potential of federal investigators listening in on phone calls. I mean, do you feel confident you can negotiate on that topic with that company?
Well, what I know is that you can't do energy legislation that's all-encompassing for the state without considering nuclear energy and other forms of production of energy. So, we've got to consider all of that in the negotiations. And, who represents them or that interest, is yet to be seen. But important to me that they clean up their act and that if, whatever it is that the federal government discovers, that they act quickly so that we can move forward, because we've got to address the energy needs of our state, and we've got to move toward cleaner energy. While the federal government moves away from clean energy, Illinois has got to move the opposite direction to make up for the failures of the Trump administration.
Ethics is obviously a topic that's been top of mind in Illinois government for at least several months now, if not several decades. Should legislators' email be subject to open records requests the way it is for people in the executive branch?
I haven't specifically thought about whether FOIA should apply to legislators, if that's your question. What I will say is that more transparency is better. And that's why, you know, one of the things that I pushed for and got passed in the veto session was a lobbyist disclosures and more transparency there. We should know who lobbyists represent. We should know who their subcontractors are representing. We should know what the dollars are that a company is giving to a legislator, along with what lobbyists are giving money to legislators, and know who all of that is representing, so that legislators are held accountable for the votes that they make in, you know, the money that they're receiving, you know, in theory, potentially in exchange for those votes.
But the people who are charged or being investigated by the federal government are not the ones, the sort of big names, are legislators themselves, not lobbyists. And I think there are people who say that lobbyists are not the problem here as much as legislators.
Well, you're overlooking, if I may say, you're overlooking the topic you brought up earlier, which is Commonwealth Edison, one of the major lobbyists in Springfield. You're certainly, it's true that there are individual legislators, and we have to address those things too. You know, there are big questions here about how to accomplish the goal here of rooting out these corrupt legislators more easily. And I think transparency is a big way to do that, letting the public, letting the press do work that will help bring to light some of these problems. It is true that bad people will do bad things. So we need to stop electing those people to public office. But let's also recognize that the legislators that have been caught have been charged with things that are already on the books, the laws that are already on the books. So the question really is, how do we make it easier for us to catch people who are the wrongdoers? I'm being given the high sign by Jordan that I've got to go. But
one last question, and it's a softball.
Yes.
For the people of Illinois, is it a net positive or a net negative that House Speaker Michael Madigan continues in power?
Look, I am the leader of this state. I'm the governor of this state, and I set an agenda. And I have gone to the legislature and to the leaders of the legislature with that agenda. And for the most part, we have passed much of the agenda that I put forward for last year. And so I intend to keep working with whoever is holding those offices going forward. I believe that it is a positive that I am getting my agenda through. And I'm looking forward to continuing the progress that we've made and to bring a greater optimism and success to our state as we did over the last year.
Governor J.B. Pritzker speaking with Brian Mackey.
Support for WGLT comes from Westminster Village, a locally owned and operated not-for-profit providing quality retirement living, offering independent living, licensed assistant living, and skilled nursing care on a beautiful campus of more than 40 acres. Details at westminstervillageinc.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, an examination of the future of journalism with one of the top practitioners in Illinois. When the McLean County Regional Planning Commission recently finished its national search for a new director, it found the leader it wanted pretty close to home. In fact, Raymond Lai comes from the same place as five other civic and government leaders who have come to Bloomington Normal in the last year and a half. Decatur is about an hour's drive south of Bloomington Normal. It might be known more for layoffs, population declines, and school closings than for developing Illinois' best and brightest. But the Macon County seat has become almost a training ground for the Twin Cities. WGLT's Eric Stock explores the Decatur to Bloomington Normal pipeline and how Decatur's more recent leaders suggest impressions about the Twin Cities' neighbors to the south are outdated and in some cases flat out wrong.
Decatur native Patrick Hoban is head of the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council. He knows what Decatur is known for. It's right under your nose.
Coming from there, a lot of times it has to do with the smell is the first thing that comes to mind. And me being from Decatur, that's the smell of money. So that's ADM, that's your Tate and Lyle, that's soybean processing.
Agriculture has always been big business in Decatur. It has that in common with McLean County. But Decaturists generally lack the abundance of white-collar jobs central to the Bloomington Normal economy that come from insurance companies, hospitals, and universities. Hoban says he saw the erosion of the blue-collar economy as he grew up in Decatur.
I remember actually crossing some picket lines to go play JFL football. So, I mean, coming from a manufacturing town, I saw a lot of the manufacturers there going into decline. So it was a tougher area to do economic development and real estate development.
Hoban says Decatur commercial real estate in the early 2000s was tough. He spent a decade trying to attract businesses to Decatur in jobs with the city and a nonprofit corporation before coming to the Twin Cities. Hoban says he came to McLean County after a stop in the Chicago suburb of Tinley Park for the opportunity to run a regional economic development firm. Hoban touts what Decatur has done in recent years. He says the city gets a bad rap.
I don't know if it's because it was a manufacturing town. It's probably the same rap that I believe Danville would get, some of the other, you know, more of the blue-collar towns. That's just what the jobs were and the industry and that follows it. And I think that's some of the mentality that came with it.
As recently as 2016, Decatur was one of the fastest shrinking cities in the country. Nearly 5% of the people left between 2010 and 2016. Those population declines and other economic setbacks stem from the 2001 closing of a Bridgestone-Firestone tire plant that once employed nearly 2,000 people. But Hoban says Decatur has transformed in the last few years. Hoban says during his time in Decatur, the city benefited from $1 billion in private investment, mainly from agri-giants Caterpillar and ADM. Some economic indicators still lag similar-sized cities. Leaders say those metrics will take time to reflect the recovery. One major sign of Decatur's recovery is its unemployment rate. It bottomed out in the summer of 2009 at over 14%. A decade later, it was down to 4.5%. That often gets lost in the narrative. Tim Gleason came to Bloomington in 2018 to become city manager after holding the same post in Decatur. He says changing a narrative can be a challenge for smaller cities trying to rebound.
There's some communities where telling that story, you know, trying to be transparent and tell the positives is more important than maybe in some of the other communities around the United States that are more affluent, maybe more things are happening.
Not long after Gleason came to Bloomington, he brought a second-in-command with him to be deputy city manager. Billy Tyus, like Hoban, was born and raised in Decatur. Tyus worked at City Hall for nearly two decades. For anyone unsure about Decatur's transformation, Tyus has a suggestion.
I would encourage people to actually visit the community. And what you'll see is that it is, without a doubt, not what your perception may be.
In addition to private investment, Ty says Decatur has diversified its economy and reinvigorated its downtown. There's new lakefront development, along with a new amphitheater, water park, and other attractions.
When you took the opportunity to step back and look at it, it was an amazing transformation, frankly, to see. Again, it's not the same community that it was 10 years ago.
So why have Decatur leaders taken such a shine to Bloomington jobs of late? The latest in the Decatur pipeline is Raymond Lai. He's just starting as the new executive director of the McLean County Regional Planning Commission. When you ask why hire from Decatur, he says,
I guess why not, right? I guess it's nothing wrong with Decatur. It's a fine community and a lot of things going on.
Bloomington's Billy Tyus says many of the ideas they incorporated in Decatur are transferable.
In the last couple of years, we started, while we were in Decatur, to deal with neighborhood revitalization. Well, that's something that we want to do here. You know, so we've been able to dig in and start to maybe develop some ways to deal with that.
Tyus says it's not leaders fleeing Decatur for Bloomington Normal. It's more that the creativity needed to try to reverse years of manufacturing declines and population loss make other cities take notice of their work.
When you're in it and you're doing the work and you're doing the hard work and sometimes it gets hard, you're developing a skill set that I know a lot of people from our community, from that community, mm-hmm. have been developing over the years. And when opportunities come about and there are applications, those are recognized.
Patrick Hoban at the EDC says anyone who can emerge from the challenges Decatur has faced becomes battle-tested. He says if McLean County encounters a problem, odds are he's been through it before.
We've had projects that were ready to go, teed up in the last minute, and have fallen apart. And you've gone through these challenges before. And a lot of the people that were a part of those teams that were working on that are still around. So being able to call them up, deal with best practices, partner with our regional partners is something that we can still get deals done today.
So if Decatur is seeing such a renaissance, why leave and come into McLean County? Bloomington Deputy City Manager Billy Tyus says it's still a no-brainer.
I don't know that the city of Bloomington knows how great of a community it is. When you go statewide, and we go to a lot of municipal events, or you go to other communities, the city is often seen as like, you know, why would you not take an opportunity here if it comes about?
And City Manager Tim Gleason says Bloomington has a culture of outside-the-box thinking to solve problems.
And it's in Decatur as well, but what I'm saying is it's noticeably greater in the Bloomington-Normal area, and we're only 40 miles north, and I've found that interesting, and honestly, it's extremely exciting. Get your creative juices flowing, and it's fun to be a part of that.
Gleason says he sees Bloomington as a cut above many communities, which is why he wanted to move shortly after signing a contract extension in Decatur. I'm Eric Stock.
Raymond Lai is just the latest Decatur connection at the Regional Planning Commission. His predecessor, Vasudha Gadaraju, came from Decatur. She's now the Town of Normal's Director of Innovation and Technology. Unit 5 found its new superintendent from a small town near Decatur. Christian Kinrich-Weichel is currently the superintendent of Warrensburg-Latham Public Schools.
WGLT is a service of Illinois State University. Illinois State provides accessible opportunity and increasingly reflects the nation's diversity and changing demographics. One quarter of Illinois State student population comes from underrepresented groups. More at illinoisstate.edu/pointsofpride. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, baseball fans spend the winter time with the Hot Stove League. How do gardeners spend their time indoors? Find out with WGLT's podcast Grow in just a few minutes. The number of journalism jobs in the United States continues to fall. Small daily papers continue to close up shop. Other than the New York Times and the Washington Post, we don't seem to have a clear idea of how to pay for journalism in this fragmented world. Jim Kirk is the publisher and executive editor of Crane Chicago Business. He's speaking at Illinois Wesleyan University about the future of journalism and joins us in studio and helps us grope toward clarity and away from muddling through.
I'd say it's somewhere in the middle. I do think what's happened in the two publications that you pointed to, both the New York Times and the Washington Post, it does show some signs of a path possibly for local news. You've seen what we call a hardening of paywalls, even across local metro news sites, Chicago Tribune, Crane's Chicago Business, and those hardening of the paywalls have been fairly successful in converting new readers into long-term paying subscribers.
Define fairly successful.
Fairly successful meaning that, for instance, at Crane Chicago Business, you get two stories on average free a month. So for us, we have been able to convert readers who have become who are comfortable being sort of casual readers of Crane's into paying subscribers. However, on any given month, still with that hardening of the paywall, only 3 to 4% of our audience kind of reaches that paywall in any given month. So we're still seeing a lot of people coming in, coming back out, not necessarily coming back in through the usual spaces to hit our paywall and perhaps become long-term subscribers.
Do they avoid the site after they hit a paywall?
Well, I mean, we're doing a lot of research on that, as other publications are as well. You've seen at a lot of local metros, like the Boston Globe, the Chicago Tribune, they've done a lot of work on their article pages. As people come through websites through what we call the side door as opposed to the regular homepage, increasingly because of sharing of content, Twitter, Facebook, that sort of thing. And so what happens is if you catch that person and are able to recirculate them through your site, meaning through links to other stories that they might like, you have a much better chance of catching them and getting them to be subscribers. So a lot of work, you know, especially at local dailies, just because the New York Times and the Washington Post have already done a lot of that spade work, spent a lot of money on research around that, are following that sort of example. More has to be done in order to really get people to kind of circulate sites. They are being inundated with information constantly, and to get them to spend more time with you is really the goal.
Places like Crain's, places like the Chicago Tribune, or any other large publication that has a potential huge audience, may be different than your local paper or your local broadcast outlet, where the audience is more fixed.
Yeah.
Should they be going to paywalls as well, or should they be adopting a not-for-profit model?
Well, I think it depends on where that operation is, both financially and in terms of what their resources look like in the newsroom. You know, I'd say a nonprofit model works in some cases where there's probably more competition in a market, and you know, you're spending a lot of money trying to get a subscriber to come to you. You know, I think where you've seen some success, like at the Texas Tribune in Austin, Texas, for example, which is probably one of the shining stars when it comes to nonprofit models. They are very focused on the kind of content that they do. It's really focused on state politics. They don't really, you know, go far from that. And everything they do, whether it's events surrounding that, where they do make a little money on top of the donors who give them money. It's all very focused on one topic, so that they're hyper focused on one audience. You can see where maybe a smaller market, if it was focused on really hyper local news, could adopt that similar kind of model.
What does that do to common public discourse, though, if only the largest entities can afford to give a broad sweeping product and everyone else has to find a niche?
Yeah, I think you raise one of the inherent problems of what's happening now, I think, in the industry. We're already seeing gaps in coverage. Just in Illinois, for example, where you have, you know, pretty big swaths of the state that are not being covered. I mean, on any given day, there's only one, maybe two reporters in Springfield covering what's happening, even at this moment of incredible news coming out of there. That is what should worry people. It's just we just do not have the resources that we used to have in newsrooms across the state. A lot of that is because of the consolidation that's happened, and obviously the business model is a little broken right now, needs to be fixed. The question is, are there going to be those in communities who have the wherewithal or are not looking to profit necessarily in this kind of gray area that we're in at the moment from a business model standpoint to take on a news organization and invest in it, not worrying about whether or not they're going to make money at the moment? That's unclear.
The acceptance of the idea of a public good is sometimes suspect in an atmosphere of scarce resources, though.
Yes.
Is there hope on that front that there will be these entities that say, hey, we ought to do this?
You know, I think if you look at the Philadelphia Inquirer model, for example, where you had somebody come in with deep pockets, try to fix it, and then turn it over into a nonprofit once it is, you know, on a path, I think that possibly is a positive model where you don't have, you're not worried about the whims of an owner who might not have the public good in his or her heart. Front and center. I do think that perhaps one of the ways that we are seeing sort of interim kind of resource allocation toward newsrooms right now is, you know, doing things that newsrooms haven't done in the past, seeking money through grants for specific projects where you might be able to hire more news reporters for specific things. Those kinds of creative financing of newsrooms, I think, are going to be more commonplace going forward.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're with Jim Kirk of Crain Chicago Business, who's speaking at Illinois Wesleyan University. Let's flip to the audience side. audiences have many more things to choose from, and they are choosing among them and fragmenting. Mm-hmm. Is there any sign that audiences are or will recoalesce about some common narrative in the country or in their communities?
I do think that, listen, more people are reading news than they ever have before. Increasingly, they're more polarized as well, just because there's more ways to get the information that, you know, you see that you identify with much more easily than there had been in the past. On both of those fronts, I do think that people are more willing to pay for news than they were in the past. The industry gave it away for a long time. Then there was this expectation that news was free. And then we tried to put that genie back in the bottle. And it's been kind of a long road to get people to understand that content and journalism and news gathering is not free. There are signs of that. You know, we continue to see pretty steady growth in subscriptions, as does the Tribune right now, as do other Metro dailies. A lot of work has to be done to get there, but there are some good signs. The question over the long haul is, are news organizations going to have to be more niche in order to super serve specific audiences as opposed to being as general as they have been in the past? You know, where you go to a Metro Daily and you expect everything from world news to local news to sports to culture. The question is whether newsrooms can afford that, in the long haul, all of that kind of content, or will it find a model that really super serves one or two or three of those audiences, put your most of your resources there, and let others pick up the other, you know, areas of content that might serve those audiences.
Will it take another generation for this to clarify, or what do you think will be the timeline to resolution of that issue?
You know, I would have said, if you asked me the question 5 years ago, I said, you know, print would have probably been, you know, we would have seen 2 to 3 days of maybe daily, you know, of daily newspapers, you know, really coming down to 2 to 3 days in print. That really, I mean, it's happening in some markets, but it's not happening as quickly as some thought. I do think we'll probably get there. It has been kind of this slow, steady drip from a print circulation standpoint downward. That'll continue. I don't see it speeding up or slowing down anytime soon.
So I've been watching the quarterly financials from Lee Enterprises, the parent company of the Pantograph newspaper in Bloomington Normal. And for more than a decade now, they have been cutting expenses faster than their revenue has fallen. And it's still falling. Part of the reason for that is the debt load mm-hmm. that they took on when they acquired the Pulitzer chain. If you extrapolate to an infinity, you're going to eventually get to nobody left in the newsroom. And from an organization that used to have 40 to 50 plus in the newsroom, and now they're down to, you know, 10 to 8, depending. At what point is the product no longer sustainable?
Well, I think we're in many markets, we're probably close to that. And it has been, especially in smaller markets. I think the decline in the number of reporters and editors in newsrooms has been startling and scary. At some point, you don't have a product if you cut all the way to the bottom.
And you have to publish twice or three times a week just to bundle enough news together.
Right. I do think that a lot of the smaller chains, or I should say bigger chains that have a lot of smaller daily newspapers, will have to really think hard about how many days they are going to publish in the future very, very quickly here. At the same time, really trying to figure out how to get people to pay for news online.
The arc of serving the audience has accelerated into a 24 news cycle ever since the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. And they were shipping, you know, reels of film back from the front lines on a daily basis. If you're publishing 2 to 3 times a week, that runs counter to that ethos.
Yeah.
Is the public going to accept that when you can still get some things online on a pretty rapid turnaround?
Yeah, I still think there is an audience that really likes the feel of print, and they like to see how a news organization curates content in print that will, you know, probably it's 50 years old and plus, with maybe a scattering of 40-year-olds who still do it. But on any given day when I'm taking the train downtown Chicago, I see maybe 2 to 3 newspapers in people's hands. Everybody else is on their phone. And that's where everything is headed, for sure. It's the most personal device that people have. And if you're a news organization and not optimizing your news site and for that phone, then you are missing. You're going to be in trouble in a few years.
People have not sought out a common narrative. They have been going to their niches and to seek their own confirmation bias as well. Mm-hmm. That's why part of the reason for the acceleration of the polarized politics in the nation. Is there any sign that our next generation is going to say, you know what, I don't want something that will confirm my predispositions. I want a broader look at things. I want a curated centrist view.
Yeah. I do think there is, especially among younger readers, and I'm talking more millennials and younger, there have been some signs. I've seen some polling that shows that they want a more varied view of the world and are not necessarily seeking, when it comes to news, just information that, you know, reasserts their own opinion. Now, social media has made it very easy for anyone who is predisposed to one side or the other to go to their corner and find like-minded content. That will always be the case. I don't see that ending whatsoever. I do think news organizations have to get better at really telling people, using their platforms, using social media in a better way. You know, forever, traditional newsrooms have wanted to stay right down the middle, and they hate boasting about themselves and about their work. I do think we're in an era where we have to start boasting about ourselves and really showcasing our work and how important it is to be fair and truthful. And I think you're starting to see at least some of the bigger news organizations do that. The industry must follow that.
WGLT is on certain high-profile stories that are likely to be controversial. We are putting transparency statements at the end of our articles that detail exactly how we reported things and why we did things the way we did. That's coming to be a best practice, but it's not yet widely adopted. Do you see that as being absolutely necessary to maintaining credibility?
I would say you guys are ahead of the curve, and absolutely that's, I think every news organization is probably going to end up having a box or something that says, this is how we reported this story. That really starts separating news gathering organizations from those peddling either what's so-called fake news or real fake news. And every news organization is going to have to do a better job screaming from the mountaintop on that.
This is Sound Ideas. Jim Kirk is with Crane Chicago Business. He's talking today to Illinois Wesleyan University students about the future of journalism. What are you going to tell them if they want to get into this biz?
It's still a great business. I mean, I've been lucky enough to be in it for my whole career. As I said earlier, I do think that more people are craving news and information. That has not stopped. In fact, I think the one benefit of the social media platforms is that it's easier now more than ever to get your hands on news and to find great content out there. So I don't think we are never going to be without news organizations. I do think if you're a student looking to get into journalism, as opposed to when I did and was working at the Vedette at ISU and just reporting and writing stories and hoping to land that first job, you do have to have more skills coming out of school. You have to learn to do audio. You have to learn to do video. You have to learn to write both in short bits and long form. So the tools in your toolkit have to be much more varied and wide-ranging.
What does that do to career arc then? If you are spending into your mid-20s before you are actually a marketable person?
Well, I do think that, and I can only speak from my experience as a hiring manager, as an editor. You know, we are where you at one time might just look at somebody who's had a pretty good college and early out of college career, just writing and reporting. You might consider other job outside of, you know, job a career arc outside of journalism first that shows how sort of varied your skills are as part of the mix. Obviously, you want someone coming in with the basic, you know, journalism skills, but it's really the whole toolkit that as an editor I'm looking for at this point.
Jim Kirk of Crane Chicago Business, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Before joining Crane's, Jim Kirk was Senior Vice President of Strategic Initiatives for Tribune Publishing. He's also served as interim editor and then editor-in-chief of the Los Angeles Times, which won the Pulitzer Prize for Investigative Reporting. He's a 1990 graduate of Illinois State University. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org.
Support for WGLT's Grow comes from FS Custom Turf by Evergreen FS. FS Custom Turf offers complete lawn and tree care services to preserve the health of yards, trees, and shrubs. Products and services detailed at evergreen-fs.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The winter months are a perfect time to daydream about spring and the upcoming planting season. And nothing can help fuel that imagination like seed and plant catalogs. But a little knowledge about different kinds of new plants can help. Patrick Murphy has that knowledge in this edition of our gardening podcast, Grow.
Winter is here, a perfect time to think about spring and the next planting season, and the seed and plant catalogs are coming out to help fuel your imagination. This is WGLT's gardening podcast, Grow, with our expert Patrick Murphy from Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. I'm Mike McCurdy. Patrick, thanks for stopping by.
Great to be with you, Mike.
Seed catalogs are full of options. I have never had much of a problem with mail order seeds or bulbs or anything that I've ordered. I've not gone much further than seeds and bulbs. Do some of these catalogs overpromise?
Well, I think there are some plants that are so unusual and have such exotic features that it may be a case of buyer beware. You might be able to get those results for a short period of time, or you might be able to get the plant to grow successfully but not offer all the features. But I think generally speaking, I love looking through seed catalogs this time of year.
I'd like to think, you know, I like looking at them and going, I know exactly where I want to plant those plants or grow those seeds.
Coup de reel, wheel right. of the eye.
That's right. So I assume these seed and plant catalogs are good for keeping up with what's new and exciting?
They are. They kind of illustrate and make available to us plants that have unique features like a new flower color, some variegation, improved cold or heat hardiness, and even low water tolerance, fast growth. These are some features that offer a time horizon for the plants, particularly those that have some rapid growth. Think about the hybrid willows and hybrid poplars that were made famous and widely distributed by mail order sales.
But you know, you have to take the good with the bad, right? They grow fast, but those poplars and those willows are going to drop a lot of debris on the ground because the wood's really soft.
That's right, and you're going to have to cut them down someday, so you want to make sure they're not near anything of value.
So we're looking at new varieties, hybrids, and cultivars. What's the difference between all three of those?
Well, let's give this a try. A variety refers to a specific population within a species. So it goes genus, species, cultivar. So within that species, there is a readily producible trait that is not shared by other members of the species. Hmm. An example would be plants that are more northern parts of our range are grown and have greater cold hardiness than the same plant grown somewhere south. So here in the Midwest, if you get a dogwood, ornamental dogwood that's grown north of here, you're probably going to have a much safer bed of it lasting and being a sustainable tree.
If you get one that's good in Arkansas, though,
you're going to be disappointed in the spring.
And what about a hybrid?
Hybrids occur when the pollen from the male of one species or genus, so that's an expansion, that's a wider umbrella, is transferred to the stigma, the female part, of another species or genus resulting from an offspring that expresses intermediate traits between the two plants. So a hybrid is marked with an X in its botanic name, like a multiplication sign.
They take on traits of both?
They take on traits of both.
And what about a cultivar? What's that?
Cultivar is a very specific plant that's either hybridized by a man, usually in a laboratory, or the result of a chance mutation resulting in the expression of this the same desired unique traits. Dwarfism, the variegation, unusual flower colors. Seeds collected from a cultivar will not produce the offspring identical to the parent. Cultivars must be cloned using methods of asexual propagation, and that's a little piece of tissue, an agar, in a test tube in a laboratory. The roots of one plant are also sometimes attached to the above-ground parts of yet another, and that's where you see our multi-fruit cultivars and topiaries.
So you talked about the hybridization either being sort of, you know, something people have done or the result of a chance mutation. Are all of these varieties, cultivars and hybrids, the work of botanists in a lab somewhere, or are some of these just simply discovered or just happen spontaneously?
Some new plant additions are the result of a more rare discovery made by a botanist or the like who has made the discovery and then successfully propagated and produced offspring as part of the goal of acquiring a patent and registering the plant for economic benefit. One great example that we all deal with all the time, I think, is the apples that are grown with a high sugar content. Black popcorn is the popcorn with no holes to get stuck in your teeth. Even the limes that look like little watermelons, they're all part of this process.
And we were talking about cultivars, which is the result of a hybridization, and that if you tried to do something with the seeds, you might not get a true result with the next generation of that plant.
That's right.
I've run into that with tomatoes, where I had these delicious cherry tomatoes. I threw them on the compost pile when I was done. They grew back and were beautiful, but tasted like nothing. They had no taste at all.
Oh, really?
So I had the visual part of the fruit, but the taste was left behind. I assume if it had gone the other way, the tomatoes would have been ugly,
right,
but tasted great.
Yeah, and you know, it's my understanding that ornamental sorghum came about similar to that scenario that you just mentioned. So sorghum is a grain crop, and it's fed to livestock, and it's an additive in foods. But there's one that looks like kind of like a black cattail that's shorter with dark purple leaves. It's really fantastic late summer harvest time plant. It was something that was found growing near food waste that was composted outside. And this is unusual, very short stalk, very big fat sausage looking seed cone there that gives it the cattail appearance. That was kind of found by accident.
And it just happened because the seed propagated but didn't take on all of the...
There was a seed that had that sequence in it that germinated, and it was probably different from what was consumed originally.
So when I think of hybrids, we were talking about tomatoes. When I think of hybrids, my mind immediately jumps to tomatoes. Are you an heirloom or a hybrid kind of guy when it comes to tomatoes?
I think I'm an heirloom just because I like old school stuff, but I'm sure I've gobbled down my share of hybrid tomatoes and didn't even know it, especially when I'm eating out.
And tomatoes aside, what's an example of a hybrid that's hot right now, something that you think people might be interested in?
Well, I think this is one that's easy to point out, and it allows us to kind of promote the Fell Arboretum again, and that's the Freeman Eye maple. That is a maple that's a combination of the silver and red maple. Silver maple is known as a fast-growing, large, but rather trashy tree that can be a liability in the landscape. Whereas the red maple, that's a hard maple. They grow a little slower. They're much cleaner. They have fantastic fall color. There's not a bunch of sticks on the ground every time the wind blows. They cross those two trees together. They even captured the fast growth of the silver maple. And the tolerance to reflective heat and road salts. There are over a dozen of this hybrid tree in our arboretum here at the Fell Arboretum at ISU. This is a fantastic tree. It's not particularly new, but it's one that's particularly reliable and a good example of the hybridization process.
How long are these things tested before they actually hit the catalog?
Many new plant varieties come from a decade or more of field trials and other types of tests in pursuit of that plant patent and a registration.
And what are some of the new plants that are out there right now that you like?
I'm fond of the dwarf cultivars and some dwarf trees. I've even seen where they've dwarfed some oak trees. They look like little bonsai trees that go in your flower bed or in a pot. I think they're interesting. And as luck would have it, because it didn't do this intentionally, I had great success with the Empress Wu giant hostas. And that is something that I did acquire from a seed catalog. And I saw the picture of a chest-high hosta, and I haven't seen them get chest-high yet, but they're at least waist-high, and they've only been in my garden for 4 years.
If you have any gardening or landscaping questions, including about new plant varieties, cultivars, or hybrids, get in touch, share your questions, and we might answer them on an upcoming episode of Grow. I'm Mike McCurdy with Patrick Murphy. Send your gardening questions to wglt.org/grow.
Support for WGLT's Grow comes from FS Custom Turf by Evergreen FS. FS Custom Turf includes a team of specialists, including a certified turf specialist and a tree doctor to care for yards and trees. Products and services detailed at evergreen-fs.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
You can subscribe to this podcast and browse our others, including our daily news podcast, The Leadoff, at WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.